welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your guest host, Glenn, and tonight I am sitting across from Adam F. And Adam F. is going to talk a little bit about depression tonight, and I hope it won't be too downer of a topic. We'll try to keep it light and entertaining. But this is a presentation. Adam and I are actually in the same ward together, and this is a presentation that he gave last week. Last week was the fifth Sunday of the month, and for those of you listeners who are still active and going to church, you'll know that the fifth Sunday of the month is when they do the combined priesthood and relief society meetings. And what really interested me about this presentation was the level of honesty, really, that Adam approached this subject. It was really refreshing, as a breath of fresh air. It shocked me, really, being a church meeting that we were able to talk about this. It wasn't without its pat answers, you know, from some of the people, but Adam really kind of took some scriptures and put them out there, and said, these are some misconceptions that people have, people think that this means this, and it doesn't. And it was kind of shocking to hear that spoken so honestly and abruptly, and I think people responded to it really well. You talked about some of the high-profile leaders in the church who suffered from depression. It was just a really interesting presentation that I thought should be heard and shared with the broader audience. So, welcome to Mormon Expression. And as an additional treat, some of the icing to the cake, or maybe the cake to the icing. You're no stranger to the blogger knackle, but you've been around for a while on Mormon Matters, and then more recently on Wheat and Tare. So maybe I'll stop talking. You can introduce yourself a little bit, Adam.
Sure. Actually, the shocking part.
Yeah,
you're saying you were shocked. That's interesting to me. I mean, I was shocked to use PowerPoint in the chapel.
Yeah, right.
But interesting reactions. I hadn't thought that it would be shocking. I guess that's just my style, just the realism.
Hey, I mean, had you done that before?
No, that was definitely the biggest crowd.
Yeah.
I've never done a Fifth Sunday thing before, so that was...
But even like in a gospel doctrine class, you know, saying, you know... You know, where you use the scripture and you say, yeah, people think that it means this, but that's not what it means.
Yeah, I think I had some kind of authority.
Yeah.
Because the bishop introduced me and said, you all need to listen to Adam.
Right.
And then I just finished up an internship at Family Services. And so I think that kind of gave me all right, you know, we need to listen to him. He's a mental health professional. So
right.
I think that made it safe for me to say some things, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I have a master's degree in counseling.
Yeah.
I'm currently doing a doctoral program in counseling psychology. I'm just in the middle of that right now. I've worked in a lot of religious settings, so not just family services, but also Catholic Charities, Lutheran Community Services. I've kind of hit every one of those. So I've seen a lot of religious clients. Also, just on, you know, on a personal note, and I'll talk about this later. My grandma was depressed for 3-4 decades of her life. My dad, who was bishop, we'll talk about that, really had sort of a change in his views on mental health and depression and getting counseling, whereas he went from kind of having a sort of a negative view of the mental health field to seeing how valuable it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of changing in the church generally, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something I should have looked this up before we talked, because you mentioned this last week as well, but McConkie in Mormon Doctrine doesn't have very nice things to say about the mental health profession.
So I've heard. Yeah. my dad actually has a few different editions of that book.
Yeah.
And he also has the one, like, there's a special thing he got from Benchmark, I think, that was like all the changes that have been made.
Mm.
And then he always likes to point out, you know, the disclaimer they have now printed in it. So I grew up not really paying attention to it,
yeah.
Mormon Doctrine.
They stopped it.
Yeah.
It's dead now. Yeah, okay. Sure. Yeah. Okay. So let's get into it.
Okay.
So your presentation started with what was it? The Beck Depression Inventory. Now that's not the Glenn Beck.
No. Although they could be related.
Okay.
No, they're not. Well, I think that was something that I just passed out to everyone.
Oh, and this was the last page.
That was actually the last page. Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with the fun. I like this. You put this in quotation.
Oh yeah.
The fun facts on depression. So this was a little quiz that you started off with. This will be a little bit difficult for people to listen to, but here are the answers. The answers are 1 in 10. So you'll have to keep this in your mind. 1 in 10, 1 in 4, less than 1/2, and 2/5. Okay, and then here are the different options here. How many people would say that depression is a weakness?
And
the answer, go ahead.
Yeah, that's 2/5.
2/5. And how many? That's 2/5 of people in the church. Or that's just general?
That's just a general. I'm sure none of these stats are representative of the entire country, but as a general rule, still today about 2/5 of people view depression as a weakness.
Okay. And then the second one.
So 1 in 10. Sorry, I gave it away. Men experience depression. It's about 1 in 10. It may be more because men, you know, the stereotype is men don't want to talk about it. In fact, there's a book I'd recommend for men experiencing depression called "I Don't Want to Talk About It."
Yeah.
But yeah, 1 in 10 men experience depression.
So that's not 1 out of 10 men perceive themselves experience depression. They actually
1 in 10 men actually, okay. Actually experience it.
Okay. And then the next one is women experiencing depression.
1 in 4. That stat's a little bit on the high side, but it's probably around there. About 25% of women at some point in their lives.
Okay.
And then, yeah, we have the last one there. Less than 1/2 of people would say depression is a mental health problem. So, or is a health problem, excuse me.
Okay. And maybe what we'll do, we can put these slides up on the website.
That would probably be
a good
idea.
And people could look along with this if they want to. And where did these statistics come from?
These came from like a suicide fact sheet that I got from a outreach at school.
Okay.
I don't have the exact. I can give you that, but
why is the depression rate higher for women than for men?
Honestly, I don't know. I think it'd be I think it'd be closer if more men talked about it.
Mm.
I think there might be. It might be worse for a man to discuss those type of things. Some men might somaticize, like it might become more physical complaints, or they might be overworking or have other ways to deal with it. But then again, also women experience things like postpartum depression, which men don't, obviously. And if we go into like the church-related thing, if you have a woman who's at home with 4 kids and never gets to see any adults, you know, that without any kind of outlet, or, you know, for some women that's really hard, and I think that could contribute to it as well.
It's not because, like, Venus is really hot and Mars.
Yeah, men are from Mars, yeah. No.
No.
I don't think so, but.
Okay. All right. And then your next slide, you have different stigmas in the church.
Yeah, so this is where the scriptures came up that you were mentioning earlier.
Right.
The biggest belief that when the bishop asked me to do this, he was talking about how we still have this problem in the church, or in the ward specifically, of people believing that depression is due to sin somehow, or they haven't repented of something, or they don't have enough faith, and so they're depressed. And I was kind of shocked by that. Like, I thought, you know, that's kind of past generations, you know, like you were saying, McConkie, earlier, like, we don't still really think that way. Like, I feel kind of pedantic saying that now, but apparently it's still an issue. And so I started to think about it, and just in talking to some clients, like, you know, where is this coming from? Specifically in the church. I know it's a broader thing in society in general too, but specifically with church members, where is this coming from? And one scripture I actually didn't list here that was a big one is, you know, be therefore perfect.
Mm.
And if you take somebody who's already prone to depression or who's already depressed, and they read that, they go, ah, there's no way I can do this. And they try to be perfect every day, and they can, and that's just a negative spiral. And so some other scriptures that came to mind that I thought of, that some of them came up with clients, some of them just I thought of that would be impactful for people in sort of the wrong way. The one where Nephi, called the Psalm of Nephi, where he talks about his iniquities and how his soul grieveth, and when he wants to rejoice, he groans because of his sins.
Yeah.
And then all throughout the Book of Mormon, if you keep my commandments and you shall prosper, and if you obey the commandments, you'll be happy. And a lot of people sort of, I think, interpret those scriptures to mean, well, if I'm not happy, then it must be because I'm sinning.
Right.
And the big one that I hear all the time is this one from Moroni. And if you have no hope, you must needs be in despair, and despair cometh because of iniquity.
Yeah.
Except they substituted depression for despair.
Right.
So if I'm depressed, it must be because of iniquity.
Yeah.
We have this need to attribute the, we need to find the cause, right? And that's true for anybody, but specifically in the church, we need to find a reason. Like, why am I depressed? Well, let's see. It must be because I'm a sinner.
Yeah.
And these scriptures just, with that interpretation of the scriptures, just really emphasize, really backs that up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I thought those were really good scriptures that you put up there. I thought it was really helpful to say, because you came right out and said, sin does, or depression is not caused by sin.
Yeah, yeah. I did say
and
that.
And I thought that was a really bold thing to say, but very healthy thing
uh-huh.
to say. And very cool of our bishop to have that be the reason why he asked you to speak to our ward, to get that message out and say depression is not caused by sin.
Sure. I didn't want to contaminate that argument by saying, well, not all, like some people say, well, not all mental illness is caused by sin.
Right.
Or depression isn't always caused by sin. But if you
yeah.
say that, everyone that's depressed is going to be like, well, I'm the exception.
Right.
It was sin for me.
Yeah.
So I needed to get that out there that people feel bad for making a mistake.
Right.
Or if you believe in sin, people feel bad for sinning.
Right.
But feeling depressed is different.
Yeah.
Having depression is different than feeling regret.
Yeah. So. Yeah, in a couple of the scriptures, you didn't mention the wickedness never was happiness. I think that one goes right.
Sure. No, that's a big one.
And there's
a bunch. I probably could have listed 50. Like
there are.
You're getting these all wrong.
And with that wickedness never was happiness. This might be a side note, but I've always really liked that one because later in that's Alma 41:10. For all the scripture mastery people out there. There's also Mormon 2:10 that says that the Lord would not always suffer them to take happiness from sin. So it contradicts itself. I just like that.
Uh-huh.
That's all. But before we move on, let's clarify the difference between, despair, sadness, depression. Let's talk a little bit about what depression is before we get into some of these myths about depression.
Sure. I mean, everybody feels, sad or tired or maybe a loss of interest. And some of these are symptoms of depression, but
yeah.
A loss of interest in something you normally like to do, weight gain, insomnia, I'm just going through these different symptoms, feelings of guilt. Hard time concentrating, feeling restless. Everyone now and again feels those type of things. You might feel down for a day. The difference with the symptoms of depression anyway is you might feel sad most of the day or irritable for multiple days in a row. You've completely lost interest in or mostly lost interest in things you normally like to do, even down to, when really severe cases, even down to hygiene. Gaining more than 5% or losing more than 5% of your body weight without dieting. Insomnia is one.
See, that doesn't sound so bad to me.
Without dieting, losing weight, yeah.
Yeah.
Except it comes with excessive feelings of worthlessness and guilt.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can handle that.
Yeah.
Difficulty concentrating. And then for more severe cases, recurring thoughts of suicide, whether you have a plan or not. Now, having maybe three of those over the course of 2 weeks, you may have some mild depression. Some people have almost all of them over the course of 2 weeks, you know, or it could be long term, like I've seen people where it's been months in that kind of situation. So these are all just sort of indicators that someone may have depression, but it still needs to be, they still need to see a therapist or a psychiatrist to diagnose that. Plus, the difference, another difference is a lot of these people lose functioning in terms of like going to work or school or just daily activities. It's debilitating. So they can't get out of bed. Like, a lot of us feel fatigue or lose weight or feel guilty or restless, but we can still go to work. You know, we can still do our daily tasks, but some people with depression can't do those things. And it's not a matter of just snapping out of it or just repenting and reading the scriptures or just trying harder.
Yeah.
That's not going to help them.
So is it usually caused by biological, chemical factors? Is it social, external things? Is it a combination of it? What are the causes of the depression? And I mean, because it sounds like it's pretty broad. It could be a matter of days. It could be a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. It could be a matter of years. And you mm-hmm. mentioned your grandmother that for decades, maybe mm-hmm. 40 years, mm-hmm. suffering from this.
Yeah. The model I think is the most helpful is here's a big word. It's called the diathesis stress model.
Diathesis,
meaning like there are some things like for in the case of depression, like you may have this genetic or inborn sort of tendency. Here's a buzzword.
Okay. All right.
Maybe it's,
I heard that those don't really exist.
Yeah.
Why would a loving Heavenly Father?
Yes. Well, guess what? We do.
Okay.
We have an inborn. Some people might have an inborn tendency or some genetic tendency for depression, and then a situation or the environment might bring that out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, one person might be able to handle whatever situation. The person who's got that tendency, it might become a depression. And there are other reasons people get depressed, too, that need to be ruled out, like if you saw a psychiatrist, like bereavement, like you had a family member that died, or, you know, things like that. Just working too much. I mean, oh, gosh, all these, you know, people are in graduate school.
Yeah.
There's things that can bring that out that aren't necessarily biological in nature, but I mean, the brain is an organ. It's biological. So when people say like it's not genetic or it's not biological, it's like, well, it's going on in your brain. Of course it is. These are all, you know, all biological things.
So there's all different kinds of things that could cause it. I mean,
sure.
Like I've got a bad back.
Uh-huh.
And I could have my back thrown out by like reaching for the salt, and all of a sudden, you know, something happens, it snaps, and oh, my back goes. I mean, it could be something like that where you have some kind of external stimulus, and all of a sudden,
I think some people can be triggered maybe that fast, but for most people, as far as I know, it's kind of like you start experiencing these symptoms and it kind of builds.
Mm.
Like, I've seen people who maybe at work, but they change jobs and things start getting stressful or busy, and they start experiencing some of these symptoms, and it gets worse and worse and worse until finally it's like, then there's the snap.
But so if they're prone to depression, mm-hmm. then it can
I think a lot of people, yeah, lead up, like sort of build up to it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some types of disorders where it, you know, happens really fast like that, but I think for most it's probably more kind of subtle build up.
So you said that you've spent time in dealing with a lot of religious patients.
Religious, and especially religious settings.
Religious settings.
Yeah.
Do you see some common threads between other religious patients that suffer from depression and Mormon religious patients suffering from depression?
That's an interesting question.
Thanks. I thought of it all.
No, I think for the clients that come to family services, they're generally just more active, I guess I would say. Like, I worked at Catholic Charities, and there were a few Catholic people that came there, but it was generally for the community as well.
Active, like Mormon?
Like Mormon, the Mormon definition of active.
Like more active in their church?
Yeah.
Just like active in the community?
Yeah, okay, yeah. More active in their church.
Okay.
Participating more. I did see a few, like, people from the Catholic Church, but I wouldn't say Very few of them were like,
they were like,
I'm going to Mass every week.
Catholics.
I'm going to Mass every week and I'm, you know, reading my scriptures and the Bible. And so I think for the LDS clients, religion overall definitely was a bigger factor, a bigger influence.
So was it a bigger influence towards, was it like a ameliorating influence?
It swings both ways,
yeah,
for sure. I've seen people use the gospel to do amazing things and recover from really despair. Yeah. And I've seen other people use the gospel to cut themselves down and dig a hole and bury themselves. So it really does. It, you know, the sword goes both ways,
really?
So to speak.
Can you share any examples?
Sure. I've seen clients who, for example, with, you know, to use the PC term, like problematic pornography use. I know people get excited when I say the word addiction, so I won't go there, but it's a problem in some people's lives. And I've seen some people in a short period of time really make some huge changes and not be, you know, cured, but be on a really healthy path in their life, and even kind of bear their testimony to me at the end of treatment, and like, that's more religious than I ever got. And with I don't bring up religion unless they do, but just really feel like they've felt forgiveness, and they feel like this confidence that they can go forward with their lives. But on the other hand, I've seen people feel so cut down by what they perceive they need to be doing in the church, and they've got to be, you know, going to scouts and doing all these, you know, the laundry list of all these different things, and they've got to be perfect on top of that. And if they're not doing it, they've got all the ward members that are saying, you know, you're not doing this and you're doing this wrong, and they feel isolated. And like, so it can go both ways.
Does the atonement ever play into that? Like going both ways?
Like what do you mean?
I tend to think of the atonement as, you know, one of these, like a get out of jail free card kind of thing. You know, like it would help you,
uh-huh.
you know, feel less guilt. But I've also seen people kind of use it, you know, like Mel Gibson in the movie Passion of the Christ. He puts his own hand in the shot and nails the nail into his, you know, own hand as a way of saying, it was my sins that Christ died for. There's people who feel a sense of guilt, you know, or like the what was the name of that the Catholic branch of that Dan Brown book,
Da Vinci Code. The Illuminati, or is that the other book?
It was Deus something. That they like whip themselves. But basically they're punishing themselves because of, you know, they believe that it was their sins that caused Christ's pain. You know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like, what you're saying about this double-edged sword, you can either feel that the atonement is something that frees you of your sins, or that you carry all of this guilt because of the sin that
I never thought of it that way. It's like putting suffering on... I mean, I've heard that before, but not from my clients. Like, putting suffering onto Christ, or...
Okay.
I hadn't heard that.
I was just curious.
No, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
All right. And you mentioned the pornography thing. This is another aside. You know that our wives got a pornography lesson today.
I heard that. I was excited that they got one, and it wasn't completely about the problems your husbands have. Although, you know, I'm sure that's always part of it.
Well, but it was. And the bishop went in, and I kind of had mixed feelings about this, because he said, you know, this is a real problem, and I can't tell you how many husbands, you know, how many men in our own ward come into me and tell me that they have a problem with this.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking about this going, I don't know if I like... I mean, I like our bishop a lot.
Sure, me too.
I don't know that I really like that approach, because then the women, when they see, you know, like a man in the ward like me, they'll be wondering, oh, I wonder if he's one of the ones that...
Oh, yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
And that kind of gets me depressed.
Well, tell me about your mother.
Yeah.
No, I think that's even a bigger issue for, say, a wife whose husband has been having a problem with pornography. I think a lot of those women end up seeing a lot of men like that.
Yeah.
Like, they sort of have their porn-dar. Like the gaydar, but the porn-dar.
Right,
were like this.
Right.
Not that those two are the same thing.
No.
But they start to see, like, you know, oh gosh, you know, maybe he's a porn addict, or maybe he is, so maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we've gotten off topic. So let's get back on. So we were talking about some of the symptoms of depression.
Yeah.
Have we covered it?
I think, we covered it pretty much.
Okay. What else do we need to get onto?
So the other myths I'd like to talk about.
Okay, let's get into some myths.
And these are based largely on a general authority. I think it was in the 2000s. Is that a decade now? The zeros?
I think it's called the aughts.
The aughts. Yeah, I'm so behind. Anyway, a lot of these came from a talk that he gave some time back. So he gives off these different myths. One is that, you know, there's somebody to blame for depression. Like, we all need to, you know, find, whether it's Satan or a parent, or we had bad parents, or ourselves. We all have this tendency that we need to blame someone or something. I think it's just a human tendency that if we can blame people for their own illnesses, if we can blame it on their bad choices or their sin, the rest of us can feel good about, you know, we're not going to be depressed because we're not sinning. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an escape when we blame other people. I think, but an even bigger problem in the church, I think, is blaming ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's like blaming, like, our depression on our own sins or something is, I think, a bigger problem, because, I mean, either you blame yourself or you face the reality that the world is an unpredictable and scary place where things like depression happen, oftentimes for no reason. And that's almost a scarier and more out of control thing than blaming yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for a lot of people. Another one is that people think, gosh, I just need more faith. If I can just... I've seen this with clients. If I read my scripture for 30 minutes a day, if I pray for 20 minutes, and if I do that every day, then I'll get better. But if I, you know, only do 17 minutes one day, or I miss one day, then I'm going to be in trouble. And, you know, what's that scripture? There's another scripture that people sort of use incorrectly, I think, here. God, where God says, you know, if you do what I say, I am bound.
Yeah,
so they take that thinking, okay, I'll make up this plan, and God will be bound to bless me. And if I don't do it perfectly, He's not going to bless me.
Yeah, and that's when, like, religion devolves back into magic. You know,
yeah.
I'm serious, you know? And, like, you try and bind God to get
the... I never thought of it that way, but that's kind
it's completely, you know, magical practices to try and... And, you know, it's interesting that you would equate faith with, like, doing things like reading the scriptures. And, you know, if I do this thing, then I'll be able to get this reward. And that particular myth about faith reminds me of a experience I had when I was on my mission, and I was with a companion who had been suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome, and I wanted to ask you about this.
Sure.
I don't really know much about chronic fatigue syndrome. I don't know if it's a form of depression or not, but. He had been in the mission home for about a month, just completely out of commission. He couldn't get out of bed, and you mentioned that was one of the symptoms of depression. And he didn't want to be sent home. He wanted to stay out and do the work, you know, which I think is a form of faith. And so he got a priesthood blessing. He asked to stay out for. You know, get one more chance.
And he was lifted out of bed, right?
Yeah, well, he was lifted out of bed. And he was put into my apartment, and you know, I was his new companion. And we would wake up every morning and we would go through our routine of study and prayers, and we'd get ready to leave, and I'd go get him, and he would be back in his bed, and he would sleep the entire day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these were during the summer month. It was July, and this was Okayama, Japan. We didn't have air conditioning in the apartment. I'd go and take cold showers, and it wasn't for the reason that many missionaries do. It was just, it was hot. And I got to a point where I felt like I was going to go crazy, just stir crazy with it. And we were with two other missionaries in the apartment. The other guy was his own leader, who I did not see eye to eye with. And he actually said to this guy, you know, if you had more faith, you'd be able to be healed and get out there. And I got so angry at him. Like, how can you say that to this
guy?
Wow. How can you say that?
Yeah.
And he just, he had no remorse for what he was saying. And just, you know, that's just how it is. Don't you understand the scriptures?
Well, yeah, the alternative to somebody who has that kind of view is not pretty either. Because, I mean, either he's got to blame the guy saying you don't have enough faith, or the way he believes isn't right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of threatening. So I can see why they say those things, even though they're very insensitive.
Right, yeah, completely insensitive, but that's right. What is the alternative? The alternative was that and I think he said this, that otherwise the general authorities are wrong, because the general authority said. And
that's quite a leap.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Otherwise, everything's false.
Yeah, everything will fall apart. And, I don't know, he ended up, I don't think he went home, but he went back into the mission home and
sure.
But is chronic fatigue syndrome, is that a form of...
People can have depression, like, based on medical conditions like that. I think there's something like the Epstein-Barr virus or... but if you see a doctor, they'll always try to rule out, or a psychiatrist, they'll try to rule out other causes. Like I mentioned bereavement or grief, but also, like, medical conditions, chronic fatigue syndrome, that can present as kind of a depression.
Yeah.
But it's a different origin, so... Yeah. It's similar, but a different kind of thing.
Okay. All right. So. Yeah, okay. So this guy was steeped in that that myth.
Yeah.
Very insensitive.
That's a fun one.
Yeah. He's lucky he didn't get his face smashed.
Yeah. So related to what you're saying, the next one we were talking about is people have this idea that priesthood blessings will be enough.
And well, you're saying that they're not.
A lot of times, no. Like... And I said this in the meeting.
I know.
And it went over very well, so I was happy.
Yeah, I was just sitting there going, wow, nobody's challenged. Nobody's saying.
I'm not downplaying anyone who's ever had a priesthood blessing and experience, or in any other faith and had some sort of healing experience. More power to them. However, I think even now in the church, they're starting to move toward, you know, there's a place for mental health professionals. Bishops are not therapists. They try to take care of your spiritual and your temporal needs or welfare, but you know, if you have other things, you know, you need medical or professional help. So even the general authority in this talk, he talked about you know, sometimes priest blessings aren't enough and you really need to see a professional.
I don't know. There was this crippled kid in Los Angeles named Benny. And there, God's army. I've given those blessings before.
Sure.
And it's always one of those nagging things in the back of your mind. It for me at least, where I want to be faithful, and you know, heal them and exercise. You know, we had that question in Elders Quorum today, talking about, you know, how we magnify our priesthood power, and that's always, you know, a real struggle. If we're saying, we're having this discussion, that priesthood blessings are not always enough to heal someone if they're feeling down and depressed, you know, I mean, that just seems like it's a hard message to sell in church.
Now that you put it that way, like, it, I was like, oh, maybe that was a hard message to sell. Like, I didn't think about it. It was just, that's just what I believed in. Like, I'm sure everyone's heard that analogy in a million times where the man's, you know, trapped on this island and he's praying for God to save him.
The helicopter
and the boat. And
right.
He's like, no, God's going to save me. It's that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
Like, I tried to present this sort of myth in a way that would be received well.
Yeah.
And so I kind of said, you know, God's provided us other means, you know, to get better. If you had diabetes or even, I mean, unfortunately, if you had cancer,
yeah,
you wouldn't just get a blessing and say, okay, I don't need chemo.
Right.
If I just have enough faith. Yeah. I mean, that sounds ridiculous to any member, no matter how conservative.
Well, and I think you used that as the example.
Uh-huh.
in the meeting, and nobody put up a fight.
Nobody's going to, oh, if you have cancer, you're not going to tell your friend, you know, yeah, just snap out of it.
Yeah.
Get a blessing, and then you just need to, you know, repent.
Yeah. Right. Read your scriptures. You need to read.
You'll feel better. Yeah. But it's really just a stigma, I think, with mental illness,
yeah,
versus, you know, a physical illness.
Yeah. So I mean, and that was just one of those points that I listened to, and I went, wow,
huh,
I can't believe you got away with that.
That's funny.
That was great.
I didn't think of it that way, but I'm glad it worked. I had a lot of good reaction. You know, I haven't had anyone come up to me and be like, well, maybe they wouldn't talk to me if they had a problem with it, but everyone's been really positive.
Well,
about
the one—the ones that do have a problem with it, they're just quietly sticking the pins in the righteous voodoo dolls.
Yeah, the two of them.
Yeah.
Or whatever, I don't know. So we kind of mentioned that some of these other myths. The one, you know, you just need more willpower. You wouldn't say to someone with cancer, you know, just get over it. Another one, my favorite, I think, on this list is having kids will make you happier.
Oh, right.
Which I thought that one wasn't going to go over very well.
Really?
I thought, because it's actually about 2/3 of women experience a significant decline in marital satisfaction after the birth of the first child.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, presenting this to the ward, they're, you know, because, you know, we're kid-friendly,
yeah, right.
Church and whatnot. Multiply and replenish and whatever. So I was thinking this will be a little bit more rough, but I'll present it in a humorous way, and they'll all laugh, and maybe they'll latch onto it. But a lot of women don't get happier with depression or with having kids, and it's certainly not a cure for something like depression.
Yeah.
You certainly don't want to have more kids when you have some mental illness or problems you need to take care of. So honestly, that was the one I was worried about, but they seemed to take it okay.
Well, no, and you know, like you said, you presented it in a humorous way, and what you said, you go, so how's that working out for you?
Yeah, the Dr. Phil line. I never do that in therapy, but
okay, right,
I like to say that every once in a while, because he always says that to people.
I don't know Dr. Phil, yeah, so I didn't realize you were lifting that from him. I'll give you the credit.
I stole it.
Okay.
Yep. And the last one, just a lot of people think there's really nothing they can do about it. But in fact, for a lot of people, medication and therapy can both be very effective in treating depression. There's a lot of research on that. I mean, not everybody responds well to medication, but a lot of people do, and it's really a life changer. So there really are things that people can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, while we're talking about myths about depression,
sure.
and we mentioned this briefly before when we talked about McConkie's attitude towards the medical profession.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about your dad,
mm-hmm,
and how your dad had a change of heart.
Sure.
Because he kind of grew up with that McConkie-esque type view. About,
yeah, he I wonder if he's going to be okay with me saying this, but he calls it the Republican view.
The Republican view, okay.
I love my dad. He's so funny.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about his conversion.
It's like, he calls it like the black and white, you know, good and bad, if you keep my commandments, you shall prosper kind of view, where, you know, if you're not prospering, if you're not doing well, it must be because it's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of grew up with that view. You know, God will provide a way, keep the commandments, you'll be blessed. And so related to that, you know, as I said, my grandma was depressed for 30, 40 years of her life, and he kind of had some bad experiences with that. Like, he didn't really see, like, her time with psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, the specialists in the state were really helping her. So that kind of gave him a bad taste for it. I think he had a bad experience in a psychology class. School counselors in high school, they didn't impress him. So he, you know, I think the combination there of, you should be able to fix your own problems. And no shrink is, you know, he called it psych wizardry. Mm. You know, no shrink is going to be able to tell you to how to fix yourself unless, you know, if you can't already do it. Combine that with, you know, the experiences he had with his mom, my grandma, I think really created this, like, sort of, like, that's not helpful, it doesn't help people, kind of view. So I, when he became bishop, though, that sort of all changed. I think that's where you're going.
Yeah.
So when he became bishop, he actually, leading up to that, I should say, he did mention that, I asked him about this, and he said when he was Elders Quorum president, and then on the High Council, and then in the bishopric, like all those leadership experiences sort of started changing his views, actually. He says he sort of went from, I don't know if we're familiar with the iron rod versus the Leona members of the church, that concept.
Give us some.
Where the iron rod saint, this is from a talk sometime back, some years ago. The iron rod saint, you know, doesn't look for questions, but just answers. Hold to the iron rod. There's an answer for every important question. You know, you have the answers to gospel questions on your shelf. You refer to, like Mormon doctrine. Then versus the Liahona saint, which is someone who's maybe more preoccupied with questions, skeptical of easy answers. You find maybe in the gospel enough answers that are important to you to keep you there, but functional, but you don't just grab hold of every question for every little thing. And so he found that as he...
Are they peepstone Mormons that just keep their heads buried in a hat?
Maybe that would fall under the iron rod.
Okay.
But it's funny. So actually, the interesting thing to me was through all these leadership positions, he became more of this Liahona type of, you know, less, you know, hold on to the iron rod and more like, I'm wandering in the wilderness and hopefully...
Is it kind of like a conservative liberal...
Yeah, you know, I hate those terms, but maybe.
Okay.
Because then people think politics and...
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe that could work. He said, actually said to me, I am most comfortable being a liberal with a testimony. Like, in the church, that's where he feels like he fits in.
Well, I know, you don't like labels.
Uh-huh.
I read that blog of yours.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just because they're limiting,
right.
And then people have all their preconceptions about him.
Yeah.
So let's see. So when he became a bishop, he was, you know, immediately put into some training regarding family services, and he was just really impressed with them. I thought they were really professional, and he quickly learned that he had to rely on them. He wanted to be like a plumber.
Mm-hmm.
Someone comes in with a problem, he fixes some leaky pipes, they go back out to, you know, the ward or the world or wherever, and then things are great. But, you know, when you start to see, I think, people over and over and over and over again, and your chats with them, you know, the bishop and the member aren't helping to get them better, I think he quickly realized that family services could be there longer than he was going to be bishop and work with these people with what they really needed. Because some people take, you know, a couple weeks, months, some people take years.
Mm-hmm.
Or some people, it's a life, like my grandma, it's a lifetime struggle. So the bishop can't just turn a few leaky pipes and make everything all better. And so he really learned to rely on that, and he would use family services. Like, it was like almost automatic for him when he had an issue like depression or something else, or an addiction, like just like an automatic referral.
Mm-hmm.
He did encounter some church leaders who weren't so eager to refer people or to try to counsel them, the members themselves, and he felt like, you know, we're not therapists, or bishops aren't therapists, and so leave that up to the professionals to do.
So family services. Now, you did an internship with,
mm-hmm,
family services. Are you with family services now?
I just finished.
You just finished,
yeah,
with them? Is,
yeah,
that like a future aspiration for you, or?
It's a really nice place to work, actually. I liked it a lot. it was a little awkward for me at first with the idea of talking to the bishops about the clients. But now, as I understand it, like it used to be, like that was just understood. Like if you came into family services, your counselor would be talking to the bishop. But now, actually, they sign a release, which is, you know, standard like professional practice now, that the client has to be okay with that. Like I wasn't just going to go talk to a bishop unless the client like wanted me to. That was it was kind of a different experience there.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. That's kind of strange.
Yeah, and how they used to do it with just like automatic, like I wouldn't want to go to a therapist where they were going to share things with anybody else.
Yeah.
There's a few exceptions to that, confidentiality, but now, yeah, they sign a release. And in some cases, it actually really helped. Not so much like, hey, Bishop, you know, here's what your, you know, ward member's problem is, but it was a lot of times for me, it was, you know, how can I better help this person? You know, what's going on with their family? What have you seen?
More, so the bishop's giving you background more than
stuff,
you're like
stuff that they've seen. Yeah. Yeah. This client told me, you know. So make sure he tells you, otherwise he's like, no, I never did that.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't like that at all. So
with family services, how much is the family services approach and direction defined by like the church and like a correlated program, or how much is actually up to the therapist?
I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
But I had a lot of freedom.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I mean, I just like any agency I had to work at, I had to write progress notes, write my notes of what happened during the sessions, and I had a supervisor that I had to report to. But I never felt any pressure to use any certain treatment or any kind of church-influenced, even like values of the church. Maybe they just assumed, because I, you know, a card-carrying member and
right.
and working there, that they're just going to assume that I have a certain view on things.
Yeah.
But I never was influenced to sort of correlate my treatment.
Yeah, because that was one of the comments that came up last week. Some of the comments that came up, why people that suffer from depression might not seek help.
Oh yeah.
Because they might not seek help because some of the healthcare professionals might not have the same values as members of the church.
That's a big concern of members.
Yeah.
And I can see why, but when they actually get in there, most counselors I don't think are going to be a problem.
Yeah.
If you have a therapist who is actively trying to get you to change your values, they're probably not very ethical anyway. Like, I've seen clients in other settings that had views that were almost repulsive to me, but it's not my job to necessarily try and change that. If it's not something that they don't want to work on, or it's not harming themselves or anybody else per se, like just they'll make like crack off the wall political views that I'm just like, oh, how can you think that way in my mind? But I'm not going to try and influence them to change that. So I think some members are concerned that maybe
a therapist is going to say, you should masturbate.
Yeah, or whatever. Like, I don't really give, I guess, specific directions to a client like that. It's not my role to become their parent or their bishop.
Right.
If that...
Yeah. I mean, like, I understood that comment from the... from that LDS perspective,
mm-hmm.
but... You know, so like I'm wondering,
mm-hmm.
even within, like, if you're talking about LDS family services, if there are differing approaches among, you know, I mean, because you mentioned card carrying member of the church, as
sure.
if there might be a difference, you know, even among the therapists, if you're treating someone who is depressed because they have predetermined tendencies toward same-sex attraction.
I thanked my lucky stars, or whatever the phrase is, that I never was faced with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't see a lot of clients, with just kind of a brief internship. I'm sure my views aren't orthodox regarding that. So it was a small concern that I had, like, you know, what if I get a client who has these quote-unquote inborn tendencies you know what, especially, it would just been difficult.
Yeah.
And getting supervision on that, and I don't know what my supervisor's views were specifically, but...
So, I mean, would you have the freedom to kind of treat that? I mean, if somebody was suffering from depression,
mm-hmm.
would you have the freedom to treat that the way that you felt that you should, or, I mean, do you feel like the church would push you one direction?
I probably just gone ahead and done what I thought was professional, and I thought was in the best interest of the client, and
what is that?
Case by case basis. I mean, if we want to get into sexuality, there's, yeah. I mean, a spectrum of sexual orientation. If someone was, you know, say, bisexual, they wanted to. I work with the client.
Yeah.
I'm not going to impose my values, even at Family Services. I'm not imposing the church on them.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't bring up religion unless they did.
Right.
If it was an important part of their life, I'll bring it up. Or they'll bring it up and we'll talk about it. But I never tried to steer anyone on any gospel principle or to believe something different or, you know, maybe, you know... Yeah, I'm just used to being... To following where they are, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Okay, so then, what are some general treatments then? I mean, if we can get away from any kind of a specific
sure.
case, when you're sitting down with a client and they come in with the symptoms of depression, what's your approach to diagnose? And what's your approach to treatment?
Well, yeah, like you said, I mean, a lot of people might come in and say, like, I think I'm depressed or mm-hmm. whatever. So, for the sake of the insurance or whoever's billing them, like, I have to figure out, like, a diagnosis.
Yeah.
I think actually only psychiatrists can, you know, legally diagnose for the purposes of
medication
and things like that. But. For the purpose of insurance, I have to put down a diagnosis. So I might go. Actually, I might even open up the DSM, the diagnostic manual, with them, and read through, you know, the list of these symptoms, and ask them about that, and if they experience these things, and make sure it's not due to, like you were saying, chronic fatigue syndrome,
yeah.
or some medical condition. Make sure they've been to the doctor to check that out, and we'll look at, you know, what if they've had it before, like, you know. What kind of things may have brought it on, and kind of explore, you know, their history and the context of what's happening right to them right now. And as I'm talking to them, you know, you can get a feel for the way they think about things and the way they interpret things. And sometimes you can begin to sort of challenge. Some of this is sort of what's called cognitive behavioral
mm-hmm.
therapy. You can look at their thoughts and begin to help them kind of challenge their thinking on certain things or the underlying beliefs that they may have about, well, my boss got mad at me. And I, you know, stormed out of there, and I was really angry. And you find out that, you know, they can't stand to take criticism because that makes them feel like they did when they were, you know, whatever age. And
So you kind of dig deeper. You kind of just ask them.
Yeah. The problem
to say, is that really why?
In a more subtle way. Person? Yeah.
Right.
But
that's like what you're trying to do.
Sure. Like a lot of clients want to come in, especially when they have things like depression. They want to say, okay, what do I do? Tell me what to do and just fix me.
Yeah.
Give me something to do. And I really have to slow them down. I'll try to give them something at the end of the session, but I really have to slow them down because what that process they've been trying to do isn't working.
Uh-huh.
It's not helpful for me to say, okay, you need to do this and this and this and this. Okay, go home and do it. Because yeah. they're not going to.
Right.
Because they're depressed. So you've got to find out more of their history and what's kind of going on for them. And then we kind of speculate together. Like, you know, what if, I wonder, you know, it could be this or whatever. And then sometimes clients will experience insight with that, like, oh, well, this happened, and when I went back to work, you know, I felt this, and blah, 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 and then we'll do more of, like, this setting goals, and, you know, what can you do, and more of the do, but jumping right into the, you know, what can I do doesn't usually help very much. But you were saying, regarding treatments, maybe I'm biased in this way, but a big help for depression often is couple therapy. A lot of times it's relational, and I use what's called emotionally focused therapy, which I think is very effective. It's as far as studies go, it treats depression as well as any medication or individual therapy. So getting a couple in there together, I think, can be just as or more effective, in my view.
Okay, one thing we didn't get to that I wanted to talk about. You mentioned last week in the presentation that Harold B. Lee suffered from depression at times in his life.
Yeah,
that was interesting.
As far as I can tell, I mean, I'm not diagnosing him.
No, let's diagnose him.
Yeah.
On the record.
Pull it out. Yeah, put this down for me. Yeah. No, I wanted to, as part of the impact of the lesson, I wanted to really, you know, take it to the top, so to speak.
Yeah.
With this, it's not due to sin.
Right.
Idea.
Right.
And someone had mentioned to me at Family Services actually that, oh, I think Harold B. Lee had experienced depression. I was like, oh, okay. So I went and looked that up, found this biography. It actually was brought on initially when his wife died, which is different than depression. Mm. Everybody grieves, you know, bereavement, as it's called in the. In the diagnostic manual, like they'll differentiate that from depression, where you have those symptoms of depression for a few months afterwards. However, for him, it was a little bit, I think, more extreme than that. So his wife dies in September of 1962. In October, he's giving the general conference address on the correlation. Like, it's a pretty big time in the church. He was supposed to go out to dinner with the other general authorities and their wives after conference, and he wrote, he didn't go, or let's see, I don't know if he went or not, but anyway, in his journal he wrote, I felt I had no place and certainly no desire to be there. So he was really, I mean, this is only a month later, normal. Later on, and I think this was sometime later, he was visiting some family, and his sister was driving with him, said he'd driven like a madman, and he said his suffering continued. You know, he tried to desperately restore some order to his life, but his mind was just off. In November, so this is 2 months later, he's sent to Europe by President McKay with another general authority to do some conferences or something. He wrote in his journal that he had slight grasp on emotional control. And when his wife's birthday and anniversary came up on the same day, he wrote, it was a most difficult day of memories, nervous tensions, and depression turned last night into a nightmare. So he's still kind of on the, you know, in the grieving stage, but it's still kind of pretty extreme for him. At one point during the conferences in Europe, he had to actually stay in his hotel room. He couldn't conduct them. He was so depressed that he had to stay there. He couldn't finish them. And then in December, now this is 3 months past the typical, you know, time for, you know, kind of depressive symptoms. You're still grieving, but you know, you should be able to, you know, sort of function. He was not over that yet. He wrote, the despair and loneliness, this is in the biography, the despair and loneliness of Elder Lee's life was only intensified with the arrival of Christmas. He was supposed to go to this meeting with President McKay, and he wrote, something seems to be increasing in my nervous system when I'm too long confined and in an idle mood. So he sort of, to me, it seems like, you know, he's still, you know, struggling quite a bit. He can't sit still. He can't do the regular meetings and whatnot. One morning on the way to church, he arrives there. I think President McKay or somebody was speaking that day. There was a huge crowd. He saw it and left and went home. So he wasn't even able to go to church, and this was 3 months later. Some years down the road, his daughter also dies at 40. So this really was heartbreaking for him. He had a lot of problems sleeping. His grieving from that lasted more than a year, and he struggled really just to gain any kind of foothold emotionally. So I think he really became sort of acquainted with, you know, the bitter depths of despair, so to speak, regarding mental illness. And I finished with a quote in this lesson, actually, from him saying, you know, members should feel no hesitancy in asking for help, because he really, I think, you know, it was initially brought on by some grief and tragedy, but it really seemed like more than that for him. And I wanted to get that message across to the members that the prophet can be depressed. You can be depressed too. It's okay. Get help. Kind of thing.
Well, I think he did. I think that message got across loud and clear. I've got to tell you, though, I'm disagreeing right now.
Sure.
I don't think he was depressed. I think what he had was a stupor of thought that lasted a really long time, and it was due to correlation.
Interesting. Correlation-related depression.
Correlation-related stupor of thought, because, you know, if you pray about something and you're not supposed to do it, you know, the DNC says you'll get a stupor of thought.
I never thought of, you know, like, crying and, you know, fatigue being related to the stupor of thought.
No, it was just a long stupor of thought, and then the other people that wanted correlation, they took advantage of his extended stupor.
So maybe
they went forward with correlation.
Maybe in the diagnostic manual, then this would be, you know, depressive disorder not otherwise specified.
Yeah.
You know, with fill in the blanks.
Right.
Correlation.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. I like that.
All right. Well, thanks, Adam, for coming on. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And hope it was helpful for anybody. And as always, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. If you have any messages for myself or Adam, you can sound off on the website or over at our blog at MormonExpression.com. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.